I'm Wendy Ring.
I'm Brian Curtis. Welcome to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. This is the sequel to our last episode, in which Vermont banned food waste from landfills.
We'll take up the story back in Vermont in the year 2018.
Companies and institutions are diverting food from landfills to farms and composting operations. Hungry people, animals, and the soil are being fed, including the chickens at Carl Hammer's Vermont Compost Company.
This feeding mix is a combination of manure and food residuals from area schools, supermarkets, restaurants. We've produced eggs for sale on this farm every day of every year since 98 without buying grain.
But then this pastoral scene is disrupted by a multi-state bioenergy company attracted by the opportunity created by the landfill ban. As Natasha Duarte, director of the Composting Association of Vermont, tells it, this company swoops in and literally snatches the food right out of Carl's chicken's beaks to feed anaerobic digesters instead.
They went from 2,000 cubic yards to zero, essentially overnight.
Technically, this runs counter to the Vermont law, which includes a food recovery hierarchy that puts feeding animals and composting above energy production. But how does it stack up with the goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions?
John Hanselman is the founder and chief strategy officer of Vanguard Renewables, a company that owns and manages depackaging facilities and a fleet of dairy-based digesters,
including some processing food waste in Vermont.
Our traditional systems that we started building here in the Northeast and we're now building all over the U.S. actually work on small family farms, anywhere from 150 up to 1,000 milking head. And those are where we do all of our food waste co-digestion. We build what's effectively a million-gallon Instapot, and we put into that container all of the food waste that we can get and all of the manure we can get. We turn the timer to 30 days, and we turn the temperature to about 105 degrees, and we make this wonderful warm environment for microorganisms called methanogens.
The methanogens eat the organic materials, producing a methane-rich gas which gets purified and used as a substitute for natural gas.
So back to that question about which organic recycling method reduces more emissions. If you just look at food waste by itself, composting leads to a 20-fold greater carbon reduction than biodigestion. Because one, when biogas is burned for fuel, it emits carbon dioxide. And two, when compost is applied to soil, it increases plant photosynthesis, which draws down carbon dioxide from the atmosphere into the soil.
What about manure?
That's where it gets a little complicated, because it depends on the farmer. Manure can be stored as a liquid or a solid. When a cow plops a paddy in a pasture, or a farmer scrapes and composts manure, it's broken down in the presence of oxygen by bacteria who don't produce methane.
But when manure is sluiced off a cement floor and the watery mixture goes into a storage lagoon or tank, it gets eaten by oxygen-hating methanogens who pump methane into the atmosphere. So if a farm has a liquid manure system, a digester will capture those emissions.
Since methane is a powerful greenhouse gas, which warms 86 times more than carbon dioxide, that's a big climate benefit.
If a farm has a dry manure system and composts their manure, they don't produce methane and sequester carbon instead.
That's even better. But not all farms are set up for it. So some small dairies with liquid manure systems tried installing digesters to capture methane and generate power on the farm. The electricity never saved enough to pay for the digester, so that never really took off. But John's company figured out how to change that equation by mixing food waste in with the manure.
The added nutrients substantially increase biogas production, and the food waste generators provide a dual income stream. They pay not only to get rid of their food waste, but those who want to decarbonize also buy renewable energy credits.
After removing the biogas, what's left in the digester is a liquid high in nitrogen that can be used as fertilizer.
That reduces their reliance and almost can replace, in many cases, all of their reliance on synthetic fertilizers.
And there's a solid component that can either be composted and land applied or used as animal bedding.
Sometimes farmers own the digesters, but more often than not, they are owned by a company like Vanguard, which pays the farmer rent for the space and a steady supply of manure.
Free fertilizer and bedding, and free heat or power if it's generated on site, means lower costs for farmers. For dairies with a couple hundred cows, those savings can add up to as much as $100,000 a year.
All this sounds good, but putting all that food waste through depackaging machines at the start of the process may be giving farmers something they don't want.
Here's Natasha Duarte again.
Essentially, what depackaging does is it allows generators of food waste to outsource the separation. There are times and places where that makes a lot of sense. Depackaging machines are most efficient at removing packaging if they're running single types of packaging. So think like pallets of off-spec potato chips all in the same kind of bag.
Vermont's law was crafted to prevent clean organics from getting mixed up with packaging by requiring separation at the source. But now everything is going through the machines.
What is happening is that even what had been previously very easily depackaged, and even organics that have never been packaged, are now all going into a single dumpster for this mixed up jumble of stuff. You can't fine tune the settings to do as good a job. And so then that raises all kinds of questions about how contaminated is what is coming out of it. I think part of why the Agency of Natural Resources was so quick to get into bed with depackaging is because that all of a sudden increases the volume that can be diverted from a landfill.
Brenda Platt at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance says leaving food waste infrastructure up to the marketplace sacrifices quality for quantity and saps nutrients from local soil.
What's happening as a trend, which is very worrisome, centralized facilities that can take contaminated materials basically is encouraging the lowest common denominator in terms of quality. Big supermarkets can mix their packaged food in with their produce, which is very clean, and mix it all together from a multi-state area, and farmers and community scale composters that used to take clean materials from those sources, now they are losing market share because, oh, we can just mix it all together and send to that large centralized facility.
Part of the problem is our culture's throwaway mentality.
Who's in charge of garbage? Very often public works departments. And what do they have skills in? Collecting that material and taking it to a place to be disposed. And this, I think, is one of the structural issues that we need a paradigm shift.
The big contaminant of concern is microplastic. This is nothing new. The anaerobic digesters, which treat our wastewater, leave behind sewage sludge, which has been widely applied to farmland for years. That sludge is loaded with microplastic from what we ingest, our personal care products, and our laundry water. One estimate suggests that sludge may have put more microplastic in our soil than all the plastic in our oceans.
Food waste doesn't have as much microplastic as sludge, but data from Oregon and Washington shows that it can be nearly 3% plastic by weight.
Plastic is very light, so that's a lot of contamination. So this is something we really need to get a handle on.
Digestates from food waste have less microplastics than sludge, but they have as much as 45 times more microplastic than composted food waste. We still don't know everything about what that means for soil, but what we do know is concerning.
Until recently, microplastics in soil haven't gotten a lot of attention, but that is starting to change with research by soil scientists like Mary Beth Kirkham, a professor of agronomy at Kansas State University.
Plastics have been used only in the last 40, 50 years, and microbes have not evolved to break down the plastics. So once they're in the soil, they stay there.
Microplastics affect soil structure, earthworms, and plant growth. They've been found in carrots, lettuce, apples, and pears. And they can concentrate and transmit harmful chemicals up the food chain through plants.
Mary Beth studied the impact of soil microplastic on heavy metals.
Microplastics attract heavy metals to them due to their electrical charge and due to the fact that they have a very high surface area compared to volume. Wheat that grew with microplastics with the heavy metal that I added, which happened to be cadmium, had a lot more cadmium in the wheat plants than the plants without the microplastic. And this then affects microbial activity in the soil.
Other toxic chemicals from plastic food packaging also bioaccumulate in vegetables grown in microplastic contaminated soil.
Vanguard does what it can to avoid breaking up plastic during depackaging and to screen large pieces of plastic out.
We have a squisher, and what we try and do is squish and then spin. So we use centrifugal force to send the organics, which is liquid, out of the centrifuge Then we screen it as it comes out of the digester.
But depackaging and mixing inside the digester tank breaks plastic into pieces too small to sieve out.
Small dairies need all the profitable side gigs they can get, as consolidation of the dairy industry makes it increasingly difficult for them to compete. Dairy consolidation is happening much faster than in other types of agriculture. Back in 2000, farms with over 2,000 cows were responsible for just 4.5% of U.S. milk production. By 2016, they produced more than a third of all milk, and the pace is accelerating, especially in the Northeast and Midwest.
Along with increased herd sizes comes a shift from pasture grazing to confined feeding operations, and that is driving a nearly 160% increase in methane emissions from manure.
Mega dairies don't make good neighbors. Jay Jordan, with the Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability, works with communities in California's San Joaquin Valley.
The region of California with the most concentration of mega dairies, where there are thousands and thousands of cows. There's several communities we work with where folks are not able to just turn on their tap and drink the water a mile, 2 miles away from a dairy that is causing nitrate contamination. Some of them will line the lagoon with sort of like a plastic. And people say, well, that'll solve the water quality problem. But the issue is that most of the water contamination that's happening on these dairies is happening from the land application. Digestate is more concentrated when it comes to the nitrate. And so as you apply that to the land, there's this higher potential of contaminating groundwater. There's also air pollution issues from dairies and ammonia, volatile organic compounds, dust that just gets kicked up, particulate matter. Truck traffic creates another set of public health concerns. Agriculture is excluded from the Clean Air Act, and there essentially is no real regulation of air pollution from these farms. We hear a lot from people about those direct impacts, and you have to remember this is a region that has some of the worst air quality in the nation. There's higher rates of cancer, asthma, and we also know that these large-scale dairies are more often located in communities of color and in low-income rural communities that are already being burdened by multiple types of environmental injustices. You see a lot of messaging and images from the large-scale dairy industry and from the natural gas industry that lead us to believe that factory farm gas is clean, that it's renewable. There are communities that live near these large-scale dairies who are being impacted, that it's an environmental justice issue and it's an environmental racism issue. We want to make sure that there are solutions being pursued when it comes to climate and agriculture that actually think about the whole system of the farm, the communities near the farm, the air and water quality impacts, and don't necessarily solely try to look at greenhouse gas emissions reductions as the only thing that has to be pursued.
There is a boom in big dairy digesters across the U.S., and it's mostly being driven by California. California has a low-carbon fuel standard, which requires fossil fuel companies selling products in the state to sell an increasing proportion of non-fossil fuels.
Factory farm gas gets a really huge amount of credit through the low-carbon fuel standard, way higher and much more money than another type of what they consider renewable fuel.
For contrast, an avoided ton of carbon in California's cap and trade program is worth $17, but a ton of carbon saved by low carbon fuel brings in $200. Farms anywhere in the U.S. can tap into this gold mine by putting biogas into the pipeline and selling the credit to compressed natural gas fueling stations.
So a third of your income as a dairy could be coming from factory farm gas.
California has also invested a lot of public dollars in subsidizing digester construction.
The state has put in almost $600 million over the last several years, putting in not just the digesters, but also pipeline to connect the dairies, it's having the clusters.
The average size of dairies getting biodigester grants is 7,000 cows.
Smaller scale dairies are not receiving the kinds of investment and the kinds of subsidies that these larger industrial dairies are. We've seen pipeline applications where dairies have articulated that they have future plans to expand. There's a dairy in Atwater in Merced County, for example, that is currently around 4,000 cows that recently applied to expand its herd to over 9,000 cows. And that dairy is also in the process of installing a new dairy digester. Are we starting to incentivize this new concept of dairy where we're actually raising cows for gas rather than raising cows for milk?
California's low carbon fuel standard is widely considered a success. It has reduced the carbon intensity of fuels in California by 7.5% and kept around 16 million tons of carbon from the atmosphere. By creating a market for alternative fuels, it has attracted over $1 billion in investment.
But for me, it raises questions. Why do we reward farmers for making methane so much better than we support them for preventing it? And could that rich reward have the unintended consequence of increasing methane emissions and driving more small farms out of business?
John says the mega dairies are here, and doing something about their emissions is better than doing nothing.
Regardless of how you might look at large-scale farming, being able to remove the greenhouse gas impact is really important. You can't turn a blind eye to the solution set and say, because we don't like that, we're not going to actually try and attack the greenhouse gas component of it. I think you have to. We don't have a lot of time. We don't. This is technology that works today.
But if our policies move cows off pasture into feedlots or cause farmers to increase herd sizes to feed digesters, then we're subsidizing increased methane emissions, first from the burps of additional cows, because let's not forget that most cow methane comes out the front end, and from the leakage from digesters and pipelines of methane that would never have been there in the first place.
In addition to the small farm co-digestion of food and manure, John's company also has large manure-only projects that sell credits for low-carbon fuel.
He doesn't think that gives an advantage to larger dairies.
It's actually the other way around, which is on large-scale farms, the income from an anaerobic digester is actually pretty small as a percentage of their revenue. On small-scale farms, on family farms, little ones, actually, it's meaningful. It is much more impactful. And our cost reductions by reducing their having to buy synthetic fertilizer and buy bedding material. That's where actually the economic impact of an anaerobic digester is most felt with small family farms. Big farms, you know, they're selling millions of gallons a year of milk. The anaerobic digester revenue pales in comparison. We're not rich hedge fund guys, you know, we're kind of people who have our feet in cow manure and our heads in the clouds hoping to make things a little better. It's definitely not, this isn't a bonanza.
Is the manure more valuable than the milk? Can the tail wag the dog?
Jay says yes, and John says no. So we kept asking the question. Rebecca Wolf is an organizer with Food and Water Watch. She says the problem is not the technology, but the company it keeps.
Digesters can be used in a lot of different ways, but digester technology in concert with the factory farm model both exacerbates the problems with factory farms and with gas infrastructure, which brings us back to that climate question. We're seeing the oil and gas industry and the factory farm industry really working hand in hand, promoting it as a solution. We now have a model with digesters to incentivize both using the factory farm model, because we need a lot of waste to feed into the system in order to generate the gas, and incentive for gas infrastructure. It is a greenwashed false solution to an industry problem that they've created.
As the show's fact checker, I still wasn't ready to go on the air and call cow manure a cash crop until I found this agricultural economist who laid out the numbers.
My name is Mike McCulley. I am the president of the McCulley Group, and I've been working in the dairy industry for 25 years. The first generation of methane digesters would generate electricity, use electricity on their farm, and then sell the excess onto the grid. As it turned out, the math didn't work out, and there was limited uptake of digesters. Now, with California and the LCFS, and we're seeing that in other states, Oregon, Colorado, all of a sudden, you've got a new market that's much more lucrative, and really, I've termed it as a gold rush. There's a lot of money being put in. Energy companies, private equity firms. I've worked with industrial conglomerates from other countries that are looking to invest. One of the major oil companies I've heard, $4 billion investment in digesters.
What farmers earn from their manure depends on who owns the digester. For the farmer who just provides land and manure,
a fairly common number that I've heard is around $100 per cow per year. So a 3,500 cow dairy, how that would work out in terms of total dollars in their milk production would be around 40 cents a hundredweight.
That's 3.5 cents per gallon of milk for manure. According to the USDA, the profit margin on milk in California is 54 cents per hundredweight, or around 5 cents a gallon. So manure would be 40% of a mega dairy's net income. Hardly chump change.
In the other model, where the large farms are doing this on their own, selling directly in the pipeline and capturing higher values themselves, I've heard $2-3 a hundredweight. Farms that are large enough could actually make more money from the manure than they do the milk.
So how would that influence the number of cows?
Dairy economics historically have been about the supply-demand balance of milk. And when there's too much milk, prices go down, farmers will call cows, they'll go out of business. Now, when milk prices drop, they're still making money. So they're going to continue to expand, add cows, and produce more milk. What we're seeing in several parts of the country, they're basically ran out of processing capacity for milk, and cooperatives and other companies that are buying milk have had to put limits or caps on to say, hey, whoa, you can't grow anymore. We don't have any place to go with this milk. We're seeing growth in processing capacity. There's 4 cheese plants being built between Western Kansas and West Texas over the next several years that will have the daily intake of milk that is equivalent to around 250,000 cows. And to put that in perspective, there's about 9.4 million in the country right now. 250,000 is a sizable increase in the national dairy herd.
Biodigesters are expensive to build.
For 3,000 to 3,500 cow dairies, $5 to $7 million. Bigger projects that I've also worked with for 25 to 30,000 cows, now you're talking probably $25 million or more. I've been hearing payback in just a matter of several years.
Mike says government subsidies, which mainly go to large farms, are driving small pasture dairies out of business.
Most of the politicians are going to say, we need to save that small family dairy farm. And in the next page, you're throwing all kinds of money behind methane digesters for large farms that drive out the small farms. There was just under 32,000 dairy farms in 2020 in the United States. There's going to be half as many by 2030.
Well, industrial scale digesters are proliferating. Rural communities are organizing to keep them out. Maria Payan is an organizer for the Socially Responsible Agriculture Project, SRAP, in the Chesapeake Bay region.
Maria first met up with SRAP while fighting to protect her own neighborhood.
We decided when I was pregnant that we wanted to raise our child in a rural farming type community like I had the opportunity to grow up in.
So they moved to a small town in rural Pennsylvania, and then the industry moved in with them.
We not only had the poultry houses, factory farms across the street, they also put in a cattle feedlot with underground liquid manure storage. The odor was just unbelievable. It would come and penetrate into your house. The health effects were so bad. We were on well water. I was pulling my child out of bathtubs with blisters all over his body. My child would get off a school bus and literally vomit because of the smell. We had rashes all the time, breathing problems. My husband got cancer. I was just devastated watching my family get poisoned and nobody caring. You expect that you don't have to deal with this kind of stuff because there's a government that's protecting you. You soon find out that they're holding hands with industry and, you know, encouraging the development. So it really does become a David and Goliath fight. And the help when SRAP had come in and guided us, like, here's the permitting process. This is how this works. You need to make public comment here. Notices will come on this website because you're lost as a community. I know this from experience. The day that they tested my son for cancer, I said, that's it. We're gone.
Maria left that town, but kept on fighting.
I swore that I would spend every living day of my life trying to change a system that is just so detrimental.
Maria is currently helping 5 communities in 3 states fight factory farm digesters. She says that government subsidies to these farms are hurting communities.
We talk about that we're a country that is a free market. We don't pick winners and losers. Well, this is picking winners and losers. If it was not for our government. Our government pouring money and externalizing the cost of industry on the public, there would be no profit margin. I mean, they always like to tout that these are job creators and this brings such a tax base to the state. Well, go look in the local communities where they have highest levels of production. And you know what we see over and over again? They are the poorest communities in the state. They don't build these next to the governor's house. So it's not trickling down and doing anything for the local economies.
I agree with John that time is short and we can't ignore existing agricultural methane. But how do we thread the needle and stop emissions from existing manure lagoons without stimulating their growth with our tax dollars? And how do we help farmers transition back to farming methods where manure replenishes the soil without creating methane?
Stop providing financial incentives for the development of this CAFO manure to energy technologies. We have to eliminate the subsidies that are poured into there and instead pour them into independent family farms using regenerative agriculture practices.
There's a bill for that. The Farm System Reform Act would put a moratorium on new and expanded confined animal operations, while leveling the playing field for independent livestock farmers and providing a debt buyout for contract farmers who want to transition away from confined animal feeding.
Sponsored by Senators Cory Booker and Ro Khanna, but lacking the support of even the majority of Democrats on the Senate Agriculture Committee, this bill will not be a shoo-in. But Rebecca believes it's a change that will come.
It's going to take a few years. It's going to take continuing to organize across the country, build pressure and support for these policies. We've seen what it looks like to have a regional food system rise to meet the challenges that big companies caused in their own supply chain when COVID hit. There's this movement building.
Here's our conclusion. Composting is best for a healthy climate and healthy soil. And while we must digest some manure on our way back to more sustainable agriculture, we should do it without digging ourselves in deeper, by setting a course for clean energy, justice, and food produced by honoring the people, animals, and earth which create it. The Farm System Reform Act will be reintroduced next year.
We've put a link on our website, cool-solutions.org, to the list of members of the Senate Agriculture Committee. If your senator is on it, please send them an email requesting that they co-sponsor.
I'm Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis.
Thanks for joining us for Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up.
Thanks to our guests, John Hanselman, Natasha Duarte, Brenda Platt, Mary Beth Kirkham, Jay Jordan, Rebecca Wolf, Mike McCulley, and Maria Payan.
And to Justin Rhodes for audio clips of Carl Hammer, and to Scott Holmes, Ken Ham, C'est La Vie, and Lobo Loco for our music.